Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, I would like to turn the call over now to Ms. Annie Beigel.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I'd like to welcome you to today's conference call, Pharmacotherapy of Tobacco Use and Dependence, with our featured speaker, Dr. Nicole Lodies, Assistant Professor of Pharmacy Practice, Women's Health Tobacco Cessation, Albany College of Pharmacy. Today's call, we have added one Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education contact hour for pharmacists. So I'd like to welcome the many pharmacists who are joining our call today. These bi-monthly calls provide education and information for multiple healthcare clinicians, such as physicians, MPs, PAs, nurses, pharmacists, who play a critical role in the quitting process of your patients who smoke. So welcome to all of you, and thank you for your dedication to helping those 25,000 New Yorkers who die every year from smoking to live longer and fuller lives. Before we start our call today, I have some logistics. I have some continuing education logistics right now to go over. I have emailed all of you the evaluation and attendance forms, so please download the form, fill it out, and follow the instructions on the form for submission. Only pharmacists must complete the post-test attached to the evaluation and attendance forms. This is the faculty disclosure statement. Ciccatelli Associates Incorporated is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This activity is accredited for a maximum of one AMA PRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in this activity. The ACCME requires that faculty participating in a CME activity disclose to the audience any relationship with a pharmaceutical or medical equipment company which might pose a conflict of interest. Dr. Lodies is on the Speakers Bureau for Pfizer. There are no commercial supporters of this activity. KSAC, nursing contact hours, and pharmacy credit are also available for this activity. And one last couple last things before we begin. Because of the several hundred healthcare clinicians that are participating on these bi-monthly calls, we are going to be changing our registration method to a web-based format for our September call. So in August, when we send out the announcement, we'll provide you with new instructions for registration. And if there's any questions from this call that we don't get to at the end, please go to the website and you can follow instructions for Dr. Lodies' email, and you can email her directly any questions that you may have. Also, many of you have asked where you can download the 2008 update of the Clinical Practice Guideline Treating Tobacco Use and Dependence. You can download this at www.surgeongeneral.gov/tobacco. If you need that again, it's surgeongeneral, one word, .gov/tobacco. And now, without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Nicole Lodies from the Albany College of Pharmacy. Dr. Lodies?
Thank you so much, and good afternoon to everyone, and certainly welcome to all the participants on the call. It's certainly a pleasure to be able to present on this topic. This is such, I think, from a public health perspective, such a significant area that we really can have a huge impact for our patients, and I think that that's certainly why we have such a large number of participants on the call as well. So next slide. Basically, what I'm going to be focusing on is kind of four core different objectives. And due to time, I really just wanted to kind of highlight the key facts, to kind of the take-home points to take away. So we're going to be taking a look at the risks associated with tobacco use. I know this, the previous call was we actually had the privilege of Dr. Fiore kind of going through the highlights of the clinical practice guidelines. So I actually kind of summed that down to about a slide or so, just kind of taking some of the key facts of the highlights from the 2008 clinical practice guideline update. I'm also going to take a look at some of the efficacy and mechanism of action of the tobacco cessation treatments available. And then I also wanted to focus on some of the common barriers, concerns, questions associated with the different tobacco cessation treatments as well. So we're going to touch on all of those different topics. So next slide, certainly in terms of the risks of tobacco use, tobacco use, as many of us know, and even thinking about cessation, really needs to be approached from a chronic disease perspective. For most patients that are trying to quit, it's not a one-time, one-defined moment in time where they identify a quit date and now they're able to quit successfully. For most patients, it can be 7, 8, 9, 10 quit attempts before they're actually able to quit successfully. So it's so important to really incorporate kind of a comprehensive treatment plan for our patients. And one of those components certainly is the behavioral component, but as well it is the medication component, and that's really what we're going to be kind of highlighting a little bit more specifically today. Certainly touching on just briefly for this slide and for the next few slides, highlighting some of the background associated with the risks of tobacco use. Why are we having these types of calls? Why do we provide education for our patients? Why is tobacco cessation such an important issue to focus on? So looking at slide number 5, the prevalence of cigarette smoking, nearly 1 in 5 adults smoke either every day or some days. That second bullet point, you see this number over and over again anytime you hear about, you know, presentations, talks regarding the risks of tobacco use, greater than 400,000 preventable deaths annually. And although we hear it so often, I do think that it does highlight the relevance and the importance of, again, why it's so important to recommend tobacco cessation for our patients. In addition to not even just the risk for the active smoker, there's also, you know, a growing body of literature in terms of the risk for secondhand smoke exposure as well. The next slide actually highlights just some of the state-specific prevalence around the United States, and really kind of the biggest thing, I think, in terms of some defining factors of why there's those differences probably has to do with two key factors. Number one, the differences in tobacco control efforts, and I think certainly within the state of New York, they have really been really tops in terms of really moving forward some of the significant tobacco control efforts, as well as some other states, California as well. Even looking at an additional factor is some of the state-specific taxes. So tobacco control efforts in addition to state-specific taxes, one of the biggest changes specifically within New York State was our recent increase within the state excise tax for cigarette products. So thinking now, we are the most expensive state in the country in terms of the tax that's actually going on to those products. So it'll actually be interesting to see next year at this time what those percentage rates of the percentage of New York State smokers, does that number change with that increase in the state tax as well. So certainly, next slide, taking a look more specifically within some of the, again, kind of specific statistics within smoking within New York State, about 18.9%, again, adult smokers, about 25,000 annual deaths, and over 500,000 New Yorkers living with tobacco-related diseases. And that certainly, again, I think is a very significant number where we really do have an audience, a population where we can make a huge impact. Next slide certainly is something that I think is all certainly familiar to probably all participants on the call. 2004 report of the Surgeon General, I think, really kind of provided and solidified that evidence in terms of the risks associated with smoking. Thinking about some of the kind of the three big ones that always kind of pop into our minds, thinking about the cancer risk, pulmonary diseases, cardiovascular diseases, and thinking specifically with cancer, there was a growing body of evidence every day that's accumulating in terms of an increased direct link or causal link with different types of cancers and tobacco use or even secondhand smoke exposure as well. Reproductive effects, as well as some miscellaneous effects. So again, thinking about these are all the risks that we are trying to prevent in our patients in terms of why we encourage tobacco cessation. Certainly the health benefits, why do we do what we do in terms of teaching and educating patients or training others, and this kind of highlights those health benefits from early on to, you know, once a patient has been abstinent from tobacco use for a year, 5 years, 10 years. And I always try to stress so many times with my patients that it doesn't matter how much you smoke and it doesn't matter how long you've been a cigarette smoker, there is still a potential for your body to basically heal itself and rebound from some of those negative effects and negative health effects associated with tobacco use. So certainly there is a benefit at any age by encouraging patients to quit smoking. Next slide, again, kind of very similar to our 2004 report of the Surgeon General. The 2006 report really helped to highlight the information that I think many of us knew, but that there was and there is documented risk associated with secondhand smoke exposure as well, leading to premature death and disease in non-smokers. So, you know, there's certainly that risk associated with children as well as adults. Next slide. So this really kind of, you know, again, I think highlights why tobacco cessation is so important. We have a very interested audience. 70% of smokers want to quit. 81% try to quit at least once, and 44% are trying, so almost half of our smokers are trying to quit each year. Again, as I mentioned early on in the presentation, on average about 9 to 10 quit attempts before patients may actually be able to quit successfully. So again, really encouraging patients that the more times that they've tried to quit, that's actually a good thing. We can learn from each of those previous quit attempts to increase their chance for success the next time that they quit. So next slide, getting into just to kind of transition, you know, so we've highlighted and touched on very, very briefly just some of those, the major significant risks, not only for the active smoker, but also thinking from a secondhand smoke consideration. And just to kind of transition into the 2008 clinical practice guidelines. So many of you may have been on the previous call or the call from a few weeks back, really kind of targeting the and reviewing over some of the key points of the 2008 clinical practice update. So as you can see on slide 13, I've tried to kind of highlight that and condense that down into what I was kind of taking away of the four major significant key points or significant changes from that 08 guideline to the 2000 guideline. So this is certainly not all-inclusive, but I think kind of the meat of some of the different changes within the 08 guideline. Number one, really targeting all patients. And again, I think many of us that are involved in tobacco cessation programs or providing direct tobacco cessation counseling to our patients, this is certainly something that is done, I think, for many individuals. But I think kind of branching out to all clinicians to really encourage everyone as they're talking to their patients, whether it's a brief type of counseling of 30 seconds or, you know, a more intensive counseling, that is going to have a benefit for your patients. The 2008 practice guideline also highlighted that we do have 7 first-line options in addition to the benefit of different combination treatments. And I'm going to kind of touch on those first-line options and also some of the literature behind the combination treatments a little bit later on in the slides. And then also counseling in addition to the use of medications, definitely more effective than either intervention alone. Again, information that we knew, but I think the OAIT guidelines kind of solidified it with that additional evidence to support it. And kind of the final bullet point was probably one of the most, maybe from our practice perspective, one of the most significant changes in terms of kind of the specific considerations of when to counsel or when counseling special population. So on the next slide, slide 14, that really highlights the 4 specific special populations: pregnant patients, light smokers, adolescents, and smokeless tobacco users. Now, these 4 specific special populations that were mentioned within the 08 guidelines, this was the biggest change from the 2000 guidelines. The recommendation for these populations above was really to promote and utilize cessation counseling or behavioral types of counseling only, rather than incorporating medications as well to assist in the quit process. And I think it's definitely important to kind of keep in mind that there's certainly flexibility in terms of guidelines. Guidelines provide, I think, that additional guidance, but certainly sometimes you need to kind of take a patient-specific approach. So I think kind of the message within the 08 guidelines was, number one, try quitting without medications. You know, but at the same sense, you may need to evaluate on a patient-by-patient basis in terms of whether or not medications could potentially be utilized. It's important to note, just for kind of sake of completeness, that this recommendation, this in terms of these four populations, was not due to an increase in, of information highlighting an increase in risk, but rather the panel based their decision due to the lack of information either showing risk or showing benefit. So there wasn't an increase of information just showing risk. There really was just a lack of information across the board. And I think that's why the panel decided to go with this recommendation for these four special population groups. I'm actually in the process of working on developing a manuscript looking at how do we approach tobacco cessation specific for the pregnant population, because it definitely can be challenging for all four of these groups where, you know, now we have a guideline that is recommending that behavioral counseling only, but you might still have a patient that is going to be experiencing withdrawal symptoms. So then what do you do in those types of scenarios? So I'm trying to work on a manuscript at this point that hopefully provides maybe some additional guidance, but kind of from a big picture perspective, it may be something where you need to still address the possibility of medications on a patient-by-patient basis, so really kind of assessing the risk to benefit on a patient-by-patient basis. But certainly if there's any questions on this particular slide, I would definitely be open to any questions to it at the end of the presentation. So next slide, kind of transitioning into, again, we've kind of highlighted some of the risks, really just took a snapshot in terms of the clinical practice guideline update, and I really just wanted to focus on the seven first-line options for treatments. So next slide, on slide 16, it really highlights, you know, again, kind of before we get into the treatments, how do we approach tobacco cessation? And sometimes you'll see kind of, you know, the two-prong effect of focus on the behavioral in addition to focusing on the physical addiction or the medications. I've kind of combined this a little bit differently, and this is actually based off of UCSF. They have an RX for Change program, which is a program that we utilize to train student pharmacists and pharmacists across the country in terms of tobacco cessation. And they've kind of branched it out into three pieces of the physical addiction, and then the behavioral is kind of branched between the habit and also the psychological dependence. So it's so important to touch on all of these three components to really ensure success for our patients. And we're going to be focusing specifically on that physical addiction component for the remainder of the call, really touching on the medication specifically. So seven different medications that are available, slide 18, highlighting our five nicotine replacement therapies, in addition to our two non-nicotine options, our bupropion as well as varenicline. Slide 20 really kind of gets us started into, let's talk about the nicotine replacement therapies first. And the basic mechanism of action, really, when you're thinking about the nicotine replacement therapies, is it's really supplementing the nicotine that the patient was previously obtaining through the cigarette. So thinking about the components of your cigarette, you have the nicotine in addition to those 4,000 other chemicals. And what they've done with the nicotine replacement therapies is really eliminated all of those 4,000 chemicals, some of the components in terms of what's leading to the negative health effects. And they provided kind of a cleaner, pure version just of the nicotine. So you're replacing only that addictive component for patients. And that really helps to help reduce those withdrawal symptoms, and it allows patients to focus more on those behavioral components, the psychological aspects of tobacco use. Next slide, slide 21, really kind of sums up some of the efficacy rates when we take a look at each of the different nicotine replacement therapies that are available, from the patch to the nicotine spray. And overall, as you can kind of see in comparing the numbers, and you don't really have to get into the specifics of the odds ratios, but bottom line, all of the nicotine replacement therapies double your chance for quit rate. So adding on that medication option, again, which really kind of reinforces the points brought up from the 2008 and 2000 clinical practice guideline, really holds to helps to increase a patient's chance for success. the next slide, getting into, I just wanted to talk a little bit about bupropion as well. So thinking about the mechanism of action, so in comparison to the nicotine replacement therapies, with the NRTs, we've provided the nicotine back to the patient. We've eliminated all those other chemicals. Now, if we look at that in comparison to bupropion, this is an atypical antidepressant. So essentially, we're inhibiting or blocking the reuptake of dopamine and norepinephrine, which have actually been very significant in terms of their role in nicotine addiction. Having that dopamine around, having that norepinephrine around, really aids in the addiction process. So by utilizing bupropion, you're inhibiting that reuptake of the dopamine and the norepinephrine. You keep those neurotransmitters around a little bit longer, and therefore you're going to lead to decreasing the cravings for the cigarettes, as well as decreasing some of those withdrawal symptoms that patients can be experiencing as well. So it's trying to kind of replicate what a patient is experiencing when they're smoking a cigarette by doing it in a slightly different fashion by utilizing those neurotransmitters of dopamine and norepinephrine. Getting into the next slide, highlighting on efficacy. Again, you'll notice that this number is very similar to some of our previous slides in terms of that other table that compared all of the nicotine replacement therapies. Again, you're seeing a doubling of those abstinent rates if a patient's on bupropion compared to no medication alone. So very similar in terms of our nicotine replacement therapy numbers as well. Next slide, highlighting now onto our seventh medication option, so talking about varenicline. Next slide, slide 26. Thinking about the mechanism of action for varenicline, again, in comparison to how does bupropion work, how do the nicotine replacement therapies work. Again, those nicotine replacement therapies, they're replacing that nicotine, that pure, cleaner version of nicotine. That bupropion was providing that inhibition or inhibiting the reuptake. It was allowing that dopamine and norepinephrine to remain around longer. This way we would see a decrease in those cravings. And the way that varenicline really works is it takes those our nicotinic receptors, and normally nicotine would latch on completely, kind of like a lock and key. However, with varenicline, it partially attaches onto that receptor, and therefore what that is able to allow is it slowly increases or increases to a lower level the amount of dopamine that gets released. So again, kind of similar in terms of trying to mimic the activity that is seen when a patient is smoking a cigarette. Again, we want to keep that dopamine around a little bit longer to help reduce some of those cravings, to help reduce the symptoms associated with nicotine withdrawal. Now, certainly there have been several safety reports as well associated with varenicline, which we're actually going to touch on those a little bit later on in the presentation when we touch on some of the common concerns and barriers. So I know that that's definitely a question for many participants on the call, and we're definitely going to touch on that. But first, let's just take a look at, again, some of the efficacy data associated with varenicline. So you can see on slide 27, this slide in comparison to the numbers that we saw for bupropion, the numbers that we saw for varenicline, there was actually, at least based on the literature to date, there was actually some increase in terms of the chance for abstinence with the varenicline compared to bupropion and the nicotine replacement therapies, depending on the dose as well. And that was also something else that was highlighted within the 2008 guidelines. When patients were using 1 milligram a day, and actually the recommended dose is 1 milligram twice a day, but when patients were using 1 milligram once a day, they were able to see kind of a doubling of those abstinence rates, so similar to bupropion, similar to our nicotine replacement therapies. The table that's highlighted on slide 27 shows varenicline for the recommended dose of the 1 milligram twice a day, and you can actually see kind of a tripling of those quit rates by using that recommended dose. So based on the evidence, you know, we certainly have seen demonstrated efficacy for our nicotine replacement therapies, for bupropion, for varenicline as well. On slide 28, I just actually wanted to put it in for kind of just giving a little bit of perspective because varenicline has certainly been in the news more recently, but in addition, kind of looking at it from an efficacy perspective since it is one of the newer agents. And this is actually a table that I had put together for an article that I looked at, just tobacco cessation treatment in general, and then kind of focus specifically on varenicline. And it includes about five different studies. And really the biggest difference to kind of walk away with for this is just to see the comparison of varenicline in comparison to bupropion as well as to placebo. And you can kind of see the first two studies, again, are just kind of comparing varenicline to bupropion compared to placebo. And this is at the end for weeks 9 to 52. So at the end of that one-year time frame. The next group, actually the next two groups, or two studies, are looking at just different dosing strategies that were originally kind of looked at as this drug was being developed and kind of in the early stages, whether it was 0.3 milligrams every day or 0.5 milligrams twice a day, really trying to define different efficacy rates depending on the dosing options that were being utilized. And the last line you can see there for the last study, it says 1 milligrams twice a day for 24 weeks. They've also looked at some extended use as well of varenicline specifically, of seeing really if by giving an additional 12 weeks of therapy, would that have an effect on some of those efficacy rates. So I really wanted to put this slide in really just for perspective. This way you could at least kind of have a sampling of some of the different studies to date that have looked at the efficacy for varenicline. So now to kind of transition into, I think really what I was kind of most excited with this entire presentation was with some of the recent news, some of the key concerns, barriers, things that I hear within the hospital, within the clinic, and probably concerns for many of the participants on the call. So again, if there's anything that we don't highlight as far as a question or a point, certainly please feel free to bring that up as a Q&A at the end or definitely email me after the call, because I definitely want to make sure that we touch on all of the questions from the participants. So, you know, thinking about the barriers and concerns, and we're still on slide 29, you know, we focus on why we promote and educate patients about tobacco cessation, you know, what when we discuss the risks associated with it. We also talked about how do you approach and assist patients in quitting. When we talked about the treatments that are available, our seven first-line options, our nicotine replacement therapies, our bupropion, as well as varenicline. And also, again, kind of touched on some of those key highlights for some of those special populations from the 2008 update. Now I just kind of want to kind of switch gears a little bit and touch on some of those common barriers, concerns, and questions regarding not just within cessation, but also kind of those options and the medications utilized to treat. So next slide, slide 30, kind of highlights what I wanted to focus on. And really kind of for the sake of time, I tried to condense it down to some of the key areas that that I think really kind of arise for barriers or concerns to treatments. So taking a look at the combination treatments, long-term use of tobacco treatments and long-term quit rates as well, smoking cessation and other medications. So what happens when patients stop smoking? You know, certainly we try to encourage smoking cessation for all our patients, but there's a couple other kind of key points that maybe we need to make sure that we're monitoring for our patients as well. Certainly I wanted to touch on the varenicline, kind of go through a little bit of the timeline of what's happened, as well as some of the recent labeling changes, and really kind of give a perspective of next steps. And then also taking a look at the use of NRTs as pretreatment prior to the quit date. So next slide, really kind of getting into, number one, the use of combination types of treatments. And the 2008 guidelines really did address the use and the literature supporting combinations. And as you can kind of see in the table, there is probably anywhere from 2 to 3 times increase in abstinence rates by utilizing the combinations. And these were the combinations that were highlighted within the guidelines as having the most literature. But I do think it's probably still reasonable to utilize many other combinations that might not be included there. For example, nicotine patch and the lozenge. Although there isn't the literature, based on what we know about combination treatments, that could certainly be utilized as an additional option. You know, bottom line, I think what you want to kind of think about in terms of the use of combination treatments, because, again, I think the concern is, well, if we can treat them with one option, then we're going to go with it. But certainly sometimes when you have a patient that's more than a pack a day smoker, two packs or three packs, ideally you want to match as closely as possible the replacement of the nicotine through nicotine replacement therapies or the reduction in their withdrawal symptoms. So you're really trying to match what is that patient previously getting from the amount that they're smoking, and therefore how much should we be replacing that patient with, again, when you're thinking specifically some of these nicotine replacement therapies. So if you have a two-pack per day smoker, just utilizing one nicotine 21 milligram patch is not going to provide enough nicotine on board for that patient to minimize some of those cravings, to minimize some of those withdrawals. So we do need to tap into utilizing combination therapies to increase, ultimately, the patient's chance for success. Slide number 33, again, tapping into that actually should say long-term use and quit rates of tobacco treatment, so I apologize for that piece on the slide. So slide 33, taking a look at long-term use and quit rates of tobacco treatments. Slide 34, this really just, I think, kind of highlights some of the information that's out there in terms of some of the long-term quit rates. And really, I think it's important to note that there haven't been as many head-to-head trials. There's been many articles available in terms of each of the different treatments in comparison to placebo, but there hasn't been as many head-to-head trials comparing the tobacco cessation treatments to themselves. And this bar chart really kind of highlights some of the quit rates that are specific actually for nicotine replacement therapies as well as bupropion. And the chart really highlights that each option really is able to double those quit rates, again, compared to placebo. So some of the similar theme that we talked about before when we were touching on some of those efficacy rates. Now, this is kind of talking about the long-term quit rates, but when you're specifically considering the long-term use, so beyond those recommended durations for each of the different products that can be utilized, they definitely can be utilized to ensure success. You know, ideally, if you can have your patient utilizing whether it's a nicotine replacement therapy, bupropion, or varenicline for the time that is recommended, for the duration that's recommended, and they're able to quit successfully at that point, then great. But if you have a patient that does need to remain on those products longer, that certainly can be something that can be utilized to hopefully increase that patient's chance for success. Ideally, you want your patients to taper off of those products at some point. We don't want to put patients on these medications kind of indefinitely. So we do want our patients to taper off of these products at some point, but in comparison of having them go back to smoking, keeping a patient on some of these medications an additional couple of weeks or an additional month or more certainly can have long-term benefits for those patients in terms of reducing their chance to go back to smoking and increasing their chance for abstinence and success. Next slide, slide 35, highlights smoking cessation and medication levels. And I thought that this was definitely an important point to certainly bring up. When we're focusing on smoking cessation, it's definitely helpful to not only think about the medications that we're recommending, so you know whether it's a nicotine replacement therapy, bupropion, or varenicline, but it's helpful to also think about even more specifically or significantly the effects of the patient, their effects of the smoking, and therefore when they quit, the smoking cessation, and how that might affect the current medications that the patient is currently taking. And really kind of thinking about, so I think it's important, you want to be concerned for some particular types of or some specific medication classes. Smoking in itself is actually an inducer, so it's a 1A2 inducer. So any medication that is also metabolized by CYP1A2, so specifically we're thinking about our antipsychotics, there is definitely going to be a need for a dose adjustment for these different types of medication. So with 1A2 inducers, if a patient is a smoker, you're going to need more of that medication as they're smoking, and therefore we need to decrease those medication dosages when those patients are quitting to avoid that potential for toxicity. So probably the biggest take-home point is, you know, kind of making sure that we're looking at the types of medications, what medications the patient is currently on prior to that quit date, and therefore are there any medications that are getting metabolized through this 1A2 and therefore may need that dosage adjustment. Again, thinking in preparation to the quit date. Certainly medications or antipsychotics specifically, that second bullet point, that are not metabolized by 1A2 have not shown any significant issues or concerns when a patient is attempting or trying to have a quit attempt. Looking at the next slide, getting into some of the varenicline labeling changes. And this certainly has been in the news a lot. I've heard many questions from my clinic and in the hospital that I work at, and I'm sure many of you have had questions from other clinicians in terms of what the next steps are. So I wanted to kind of start off, first of all, of kind of going through a little bit of the timeline. So varenicline originally was approved in May 2006. Some of the initial reports really started to come in last November, so November 2007, really highlighting some of these reports of suicidal ideations, erratic behavior. So the reports were starting to build, and I think at that point the FDA really said, you know, we're definitely seeing more information. We need to kind of put more of a heightened view on what's going on specifically. Is there a direct link of varenicline with some of these reports? In February 2008, as I think many of us know, varenicline label was updated to highlight these two concerns. And I kind of summarized that in the first bullet of a kind of a brief synopsis. Number one, the point was to monitor patients. All patients that were utilizing varenicline should be monitored for behavior or mood changes. So educating patients to make sure that they were aware of this, as well as family members or friends or colleagues of the patient. And then the second piece that was added to the labeling changes due to the increase in drowsiness was to use caution when driving or operating machinery. Now, again, kind of going back to the timeline, since the labeling update, reports have continued to kind of increase in terms of some of the most recent news. In May 2008, many of you may or may not have seen this, the FAA, so the Federal Aviation Administration, actually announced that it was going to be prohibiting the use of varenicline in its pilots, its air traffic controllers, anyone where, you know, that lapse in alertness would create a potential for an issue. Kind of putting it into perspective as well, it is important to note that antidepressants as well are also prohibited by the FAA for use in pilots. Now, one of the more kind of significant very recent pieces of news was a report that was submitted to the FDA by an organization called ISMP, Institute of Safe Medication Practices. And this was actually submitted to the FDA and is available on the website for viewing. What the ISMP really did was try to, and again, that's the Institute for Safe Medication Practices, they were really trying to kind of summarize all of these reports that were coming in and put it together in a comprehensive document highlighting all of the potential adverse effects reported and associated, or at least potentially associated with varenicline. They submitted this report to the FDA, and really the recommendation was to encourage further investigation to establish, you know, if this causal link actually did exist. But it was certainly something that I think kind of from a clinical perspective heightens the awareness in terms of some of the potential for concern with the medication. I think bottom line, when we're talking about some of these recent labeling changes, concerns, if you get them from other clinicians or patients, colleagues, you know, you want to kind of think about, I think, three key pieces that I wanted to kind of leave almost as kind of my take-home message or my take-home point for some of these varenicline labeling changes. Number one, patients with a psychiatric history were actually not involved in the initial studies. So that could be why we're seeing some of these increased reports. That doesn't account for all of the reports, though. Certainly many reports have included in patients that did not have a psychiatric history. Number two, the current labeling, I believe, you know, certainly reflects some key information, but that needs to be educated and communicated back to our patients. We need to make sure that patients are being monitored and are aware of some of the information that is out there, as well as the increased risk for drowsiness as well. And there are a number, number three, there are a number of reports that are out there in terms of the data, the evidence, that are really kind of lacking. We know that there's a lot of reports that are building in terms of some of these adverse effects, but there hasn't been that direct link associated with it. And I believe that was really kind of the driving force for the Safe Medication Practices report to recommend to the FDA, you know, all of these reports are really starting to build. We need to find out what the direct link is. We need to find out what's the mechanism of what's going on. Is there this causal relationship? Do we need to have more concern than what the current labeling actually states? So hopefully within the coming months, I think it's reasonable to certainly consider it as an option for our patients. On the positive side, varenicline has demonstrated great efficacy, but on the negative side, with some of these building reports, the ISMP report, the increasing adverse events that have been reported regarding patients of varying different types of backgrounds. So I think bottom line, you need to really kind of weigh those risks to benefits when varenicline is being considered as an option for patients. Patients need to be, if this becomes an option that patients are considering, they need to be monitored and communicated regarding the data that's available that we know at this point. And certainly, again, I would open this up to any questions as we're starting to kind of wrap up the presentation regarding this particular point. And kind of going into the final key piece here, the use of nicotine replacement therapies prior to quitting. There's actually, and this was highlighted within the 2008 guidelines, there was two studies that have been available, Sherman's and colleagues. Kind of the primary outcome was to look at the use of patches 2 weeks prior and then having patients 2 weeks prior to the quit date, and then having patients continue with the patches for 12 weeks post the quit date. And the results actually showed that there was an increase in those abstinence rates for patients that used the patches prior to the quit date compared to patients that, you know, started their patches as recommended of starting it on day one of the quit date. Rose and colleagues was another study that kind of had the same goals and outcomes, was to look at the use of the patch prior to the quit date compared to patients that were starting the patch on day one of the quit date. And actually what they found in Rose and colleagues was that there was an increase in those abstinent rates at 4 weeks, but they didn't find any significant difference when you carried out the study longer than that, so when we followed up patients after that. So thinking about, you know, what is recommended within the 2008 guidelines, really the key message that they recommended was that based on the limited information that we have, at least to date, it isn't recommended to utilize nicotine replacement therapies prior to the quit date. So patients should still be starting that nicotine replacement therapy on day one of their quit date. But this may be something where certainly more literature, more information is needed to really have kind of a sense of could there be a potential for a benefit of starting this prior to quitting. So final slide on slide 41, really just to kind of summarize, tobacco use cessation needs to be approached from a chronic disease perspective. Really thinking about the target, you have the physical dependence. We kind of highlighted several different first-line options. It's also important to touch on that habit component, to touch on the psychological dependence. And by touching on all three of those, you're going to help to increase the chance for success for your patients. And then finally, highlighting, we talked about a couple of the kind of the five most common barriers and concerns associated with some of the different tobacco cessation treatments. So I'm hoping that I provided kind of a great overview in terms of touching on some of those barriers and concerns, but at the same time, certainly I welcome and open up any types of questions that participants have to address further on some of those components. And then finally, slide 42 really just touches on some of the different resources that are available. And I really just want to focus specifically on that first one. New York State Quitline really provides a very effective, comprehensive resource for our patients and clinicians, providers across the state. They do some one-on-one free coaching, as well as nicotine replacement therapy starter kits. And at this point, I'm actually going to toss things over to Pat, who's the marketing director, and then we'll open it up to questions and answers. Pat?
Thank you so much, Nicole. For those that may not be familiar with the New York State Smokers Quitline, I just want to take a moment to highlight our services. The Quitline is a free and confidential program that provides evidence-based stop smoking services to all New York State residents who want to stop smoking or using other forms of tobacco. And probably one of the services that generates the most number of calls is really for the free nicotine replacement therapy. And we provide free patches, gum, or lozenges in the form of a starter kit, 2 weeks for most residents that qualify, and up to 6 weeks for Medicaid and uninsured residents. We also have an online registration for free patches, and you can go right to our website, which is www.nysmokefree.com on the right-hand side of our homepage. The other highlight of our services includes our coaching by our Quitline specialists. And we have extensive information on our website. We have links to other supportive websites and educational resources, as well as some written materials that you can request from our Quitline that you can display and provide to your patients. We are here to support your cessation efforts in every way that we can, and we do invite you to call us directly and speak to any of our specialists if you have questions or additional information. Our number is 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487. And on behalf of the Quitline, I want to thank you for your efforts in promoting our services. And at this time, I'd like to turn it back to Nicole.
Okay, at this time I think we're going to open the lineup for questions.
Thank you, Nicole. If you have questions at this time, you may press 01 on your telephone keypad. Once again, to ask a question at this time, you may press 01 on your telephone keypad. And the first question in the queue comes from Julie Chrysler. Go ahead, ma'am.
Yeah, I was wondering on the Chantix. It says here that you monitor patients for behavioral changes and mood changes. Would you expect that anyway, being that they're in a situation where they're quitting smoking?
Absolutely, and I think that's an excellent question. You mentioned your name was Julie, correct?
No, I'm Cindy. I'm with Julie, though.
Cindy, okay. That's an excellent question, and I think that is where, so the question really was, you know, in terms of the monitoring for varenicline, of monitoring any types of behavior or mood changes, would you expect that anyways for a patient just in the fact of them quitting smoking, so kind of, you know, drug aside, and that's absolutely correct. And I think at this point, what really needs to be the next step to really define if there are some bigger issues rather than just some basic mood changes that are normally accompanied by tobacco cessation is we need to do some further, there needs to be further evaluation within the FDA. And then I think is really what was the driving force from the ISMP report to say that, you know, we have all these reports, we know that there's the updated labeling changes, but we need to find out more information to see what the direct causal link is.
Thank you.
Okay, I do have four more questions in the queue, and the next one comes from Maureen Ross.
Yes, I was wondering, can you speak a little bit about using Wellbutrin in your hypertensive patients?
So the question in terms of using Wellbutrin or bupropion in hypertensive patients, that hasn't been an issue for us. Actually, I'm in a women's health clinic, so we tend to, for many of our patients, actually up until the guidelines, we tend to kind of promote many of the different nicotine replacement therapies as well, or any of the different options. But we haven't really noticed any difference or any specific concerns of using it within our patients. Again, you're trying to make sure that these patients are adequately controlled no matter what the other disease states are, and then adding on the bupropion as well. So we haven't actually noticed any significant changes or any significant concerns of using bupropion within our hypertensive patients.
Okay, are you ready for the next question, ma'am?
Yes.
The next question comes from Anne Maureen.
Hi, this is Laura Giardino. I'm with Anne. I just needed some clarification about the pretreatment with nicotine replacement therapies. Were you speaking in relation to pretreating prior to the quit date when you're using varenicline or any?
That is an excellent question. This, what I was focusing on specifically was the use of nicotine replacement therapies. prior to the quit date. So thinking about in comparison, for bupropion, you typically do, and it is recommended to start that 1 to 2 weeks prior to the quit date. And the that basically allows the patient to get enough therapeutic levels to start kind of taking activity of the drug. For varenicline, you also start it about a week prior to the quit date, and that's really for the purpose of minimizing some of the side effects. One of the major side effects is nausea associated with it. So when I was kind of talking about it within the slides, that was actually specific for the use of nicotine replacement therapies, because traditionally they've been recommended primarily just to start on that day one, first day of quit date. So both of those studies were kind of taking a look at something a little bit different from what was typically recommended of saying, well, what would happen if we gave the patient the patch, you know, 2 weeks prior to the quit date? So as they are still smoking, maybe starting to reduce the numbers of cigarettes that they're smoking in preparation, would that have either a positive or negative effect on those abstinence rates? So does that provide clarification?
Yeah, so are you suggesting that they continue smoking while they're using the nicotine replacement, the patch?
Well, these are actually two of the two studies that I mentioned, that is what was done in those particular studies, that they were evaluating having the patients prior to actually stopping smoking start on the patch therapy 2 weeks prior to those quit dates. What was recommended in the guidelines is they're actually not advocating doing that. The guidelines are actually staying consistent with the product guidelines, which is to start those nicotine replacement therapies on day one when patients have actually quit smoking. So to not recommend utilizing a nicotine replacement therapy at the same time as smoking a cigarette. But that is something that is being evaluated or may certainly be evaluated in the future in terms of seeing if there could be any either additional benefit or even potential for risk. Both of those studies actually did not highlight any increased potential for risk. But bottom line, as far as the guidelines are concerned, and what I would recommend would still be to start the nicotine replacement therapy day one for the quit date. So after the patient has actually quit smoking, then starting them on a nicotine replacement therapy.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And the next question in the queue comes from Linda's office.
I would like to know if you have a very heavy smoker, and it's not recommended, but can they wear two patches?
Yes, that is a great question. So the question was in terms of if you have a very heavy smoker, can they wear two patches? Absolutely. I think ultimately it's something where, you know, you have to look at how much nicotine is that patient currently exposed to, you know, whether it's a 2-pack per day smoker or it's a 3-pack per day smoker, and therefore that's really what their body is used to. So if we only supplement, you know, a 2-pack per day smoker with one patch, they're still going to have cravings. They're still going to have some probably significant withdrawal symptoms. So it is appropriate to try as close as possible to utilize, if you would need to, you know, utilizing two patches, for example, for that 2-pack-a-day smoker. Now, there's not as much literature that's out there in terms of utilizing multiple patches. The most that I've seen, and I believe there might be another study that looked at three patches, but the most that I've seen has been the use of two patches on one patient at the same time, and it didn't present any increase in terms of risk. Again, bottom line, you're thinking, how much is the patient currently smoking? And then can we try to replicate and provide as close to the amount of nicotine in terms of what we're actually replacing? Now, that could be in the form of two patches, or it could be something where if you have a provider or a clinician or you yourself that's saying, you know, I feel kind of uncomfortable using the two patches, maybe utilizing, you know, a different combination, which there is more literature of two different products. Rather than two of the same product. Does that answer your question?
Did it answer the question she's asking?
Yes.
Okay.
I have, what would you recommend, like, with the two patches, would you say two packs or three packs and better?
Well, I guess so your question is for the use of two patches, what does that kind of equate to, a 2-pack per day smoker or a 3-pack per day smoker? Is that your question?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I guess kind of taking a step back from that, it's important. I mean, on average, most cigarettes have about 1 to 1.2 milligrams of nicotine in them. So it's helpful to really be, if we really want to kind of, you know, get down to the wire in terms of being as accurate as possible, it's helpful to kind of have a sense of what particular brand of cigarette is the patient smoking, and there, do they have, you know, 0.9 milligrams of nicotine per cigarette, or 1 or 1.2. You know, if we're thinking just as a gross estimate, probably two packs would probably equate to utilizing two patches, as well as what we use now of one pack per day smoker typically utilizes one patch.
Okay, Dr. Lodis, this is Annie Beigel. We are coming to the top of the hour, which is time to conclude the call. I think we could take one more question.
It's coming from Meryl. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. My name is Meryl Parada, and I was very interested in hearing you had mentioned that you are working on a paper regarding the pregnant population. I also work in a women's center, and specifically, I'm working with pregnant women and helping them to quit. Could you just tell a little bit about what you're planning on putting into the paper, or any information you could share with us presently?
Yes, it was actually something where I kind of started working on recently with kind of the updated guidelines. As I mentioned, I work in a women's health clinic. That's kind of one of my components, in addition to seeing patients within our hospital-wide smoking cessation service. But within the women's health clinic, as you mentioned, it sounds like you're in a similar scenario. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of pregnant patients, and it was something where we knew that there was still a need, even when that the update came out, in terms of, you know, and certainly understanding their rationale. It wasn't due to an increase of risk, but really just due to a lack of information across the board,
mm-hmm.
Whether showing risk or whether showing benefit. So what I'm going to be putting together, and I don't have kind of all the specifics, is hopefully at least kind of a recommended treatment approach or another treatment approach in terms of, you know, what could be kind of your stepwise approach when you have that pregnant patient. And certainly trying, you know, behavioral options, trying habits might be that first, you know, that first step for your patients. But if your patient still has cravings, if your patient still has withdrawal symptoms, which many pregnant patients,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's a pack a day or two packs or even a half a pack, they might still be experiencing that, we need to come up with still kind of a next kind of game plan for the patient. So I don't have any specifics right now,
okay.
in terms of one to recommend, but that is definitely something that I would say kind of keep your eyes out, because I am putting together a manuscript to be submitted for publication in terms of kind of a recommended treatment approach for pregnant patients. You know, again, taking a look at the literature that's currently out to date, and hopefully any future literature that will be becoming available in terms of based on the information that we currently have, you know, what could at least be our first option for a nicotine replacement therapy, for example. If that is something that needs to be used and that's communicated to the patient and everybody's kind of on board in terms of the risk to benefit for that particular patient, you know, what could be kind of our stepwise approach. So I'm hoping that answers your question.
Okay. On behalf of Dr. Lodis, on behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, we sincerely want to thank you for today's presentation to New York State's healthcare community. And those of you who are listening, please mark your calendars. Our next conference call will be on September 3rd, titled Maximizing the Medicaid Benefit. And this brings us to the end of today's call. Thank you to all of you for participating, and have a good day.